welcome to episode 38 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast, The 30-Foot Bride of Candy Rock. I'm Jerry Shario, and as always, it is my pleasure to introduce to you our host, playwright, director, actor, musician, author of The Annotated Abbott and Costello, the book that made all this podcast possible, and soon to begin work on his next book, The Port St. Lucie Annotated Bus Schedules. Here's Nick Santa Maria.
Hey, that's not fair, F-A-R-E. So we'll just transfer it to some other topic. So I got fair in there. I've got transfer in there.
Yes, yes. You really know how to conduct a joke. That's good.
Don't I? I try. Very funny. Oh, my. Look, you're steering us into a bad place. And it's terminal. So anyway... that one even made me laugh, which is kind of a regular thing here. Somebody's got to. Anyway, welcome, everyone. Welcome to number 38. We're heading towards that big 40 number. My goodness. Ooh. And boy, you would have, when I mentioned in passing in the last episode that we're at number 37, and I said, we're close to Jack Benny. I got like things from people saying, how is this attached to Jack Benny? What do you mean? You know, what? And I'm like, number 39, 39. That's Jack Benny's age. Anyway, so just so they understand that. Interesting stuff. My friend Jerry is leaving for New York on Saturday.
Yes.
On a boat for Cleveland. No, wait, you're going to New York. I'm sorry. I just had a slight stroke. But you're going to New York to rehearse Miracle on 34th Street.
Yes.
And are you rehearsing on 34th Street?
I honestly don't think so. It's somewhere in lower Manhattan. I've got the address written down. I wrote it down so I don't have to remember it.
Ah, I love lower comedy. Yeah. But so you are playing the judge and you are playing Mr. Gimble.
That's right.
And this is very exciting. So you're going to be doing rehearsals there in New York. Then you're heading up to another Jack Benny reference. You're heading up to Rochester. New York, where everybody in the cast talks with a raspy voice. But and then you're going to do tech there, up there. You're going to do the dress rehearsals and everything. Yep. And when are you opening? You know?
I believe it's the 21st or 22nd of November. We're in Rochester for a few performances. And then we hit the road. And we'll be getting as far west as Detroit, as far south as into Virginia. And mostly up in the Northeast. So if anybody listening out there sees a Miracle on 34th Street's coming to your town in that area, give it a look.
You get to see Jerry. And you get to meet him afterwards. I'm sure he'll sign programs and stuff.
Right? Of course. Of course.
Attaboy. That's my boy. I'm very excited for you. I think that's great news. So here, I was just telling Jerry, it's like I live in Florida, not by choice, but to help my mom as a caregiver. And I'm not a fan of Florida, to be honest with you. But the weather is just monotonous, you know, for a while. But all of a sudden, you get to the end of October, and the weather starts changing. And you can't wait to get outside. It's just really, really nice. There are certain things about Florida that are just delightful. And that's one of them. I love it. During my walk, it's just beautiful. But anyway, we're getting to a topic here that is slightly sad, I would say. It is the final film for Lou Costello, and it's without Abbott. It's actually a couple of years after their breakup he made this film. But it's very interesting to me because Lou, at this point in his career, was very, very, very careful about what he was accepting. He was really on the lookout for the next thing. Meaning that he didn't want to go into more slapstick. He wanted to go into more pathos and more dramatic stuff or even like sitcom stuff. They even talked about him hosting a game show, which I don't think would have been a great idea because he wasn't, how can I say this? He wasn't verbally as acrobatic as some of the others. He didn't have that kind of polish in his talk. So I really can't see that. And he wasn't really known as a wit. He was more of a improvisational, physical comedian, more than anything. So, yeah, I'm not sure that would have worked out. But anyway, we're talking about a movie he did accept, and it was against his better judgment, to be honest with you. He read the script. It's not exactly what he was looking for, but he wasn't exactly being offered a lot of great things. He was up for a role in a movie called The Mating Game with Debbie Reynolds and Tony Randall, playing Debbie Reynolds' father, which would have been a great role for him. But it went to Paul Douglas, who unfortunately died that same year, the same year Lou died. So maybe that was a cursed production. So he didn't get that. They were in discussions about a film about Fiorello LaGuardia, who he resembled very much. And that didn't happen. And there were a few other things they were considering. But this movie came along. He read it. And apparently the script he read, and listen to this, Lou is reading scripts now. He's getting serious now. He doesn't have his partner to, you know, play volleyball with the dialogue. But he read the script, and it was a lot more interesting than it eventually turned out to be, because everybody thought the budget was going to be bigger, that they were going to have huge hands coming in and, you know, things like King Kong had, you know, back in 1933. Yeah. But unfortunately, the budget was only $700,000, which actually is about the amount of an Abbott and Costello film at Universal. I was surprised to see how much it was, considering that Dance with Me Henry was almost half as much. It was like $450,000. So this had a decent budget, but not the budget everyone wanted. They really wanted to make this an impressive science fiction comedy. They all wanted a higher budget to make it a more interesting looking film. Unfortunately, rather than those larger props that Lou could have played with and imagine what he could have done physically.
Yeah.
Instead, it was all process shots. And they say the director, Sidney Miller, said that Lou had a little trouble on the set. He never worked that way before. Number one, he was on a new lot. He was on the Columbia lot. He was in Stooge land. Basically, he was working with a new director, and he was working with special effects that he had no idea, you know, where do I look? Where is she? Where's her face? You know, difficult stuff, especially for someone who's been in it for so long.
Yeah.
But he was game for anything. He was really wanted to try, despite the fact that he looks really bad. He really looks thin. His face is lined. He looks all of his 52 years here. He really does. And it's a big mistake to dress him in that short sleeve shirt, because it makes him look like a senior citizen. It makes him look older. It's what I noticed anyway.
Yeah. Now that you mention it, I never thought of the reason behind it, but I did note that it didn't look quite right. I couldn't put my finger on it, but yeah, that makes perfect sense. It aged him even more so.
It did age him. Yeah. And very clear. This is the clearest, his bracelet, his Butch bracelet. When Butch died, he had a bracelet made with the baby's name on it, and it was welded to his wrist. He couldn't take it off. So it's all over the movie. But anyway, I thought that was a very poor decision. And the biggest poor decision, as far as I'm concerned, is the fact that Dorothy Provine was about 23, 24 years old when she made this movie.
Yeah.
Lou was 52. And they were acting like young lovers trying to get away from the parents and going to Dinosaur Canyon, and she's trying to seduce him. It's really uncomfortable. I'm sorry, but it doesn't look good. And there's one point where one of the guys who works in Gail Gordon's bank, he looks like he's 26, and he's like asking, can I take your niece out? You know, blah, blah. And he's like, no, you can't, blah, 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 blah. So the choice between this 26-year-old guy and someone twice his age wearing short sleeves, it's uncomfortable. It's pretty uncomfortable. But anyway, they do their best under the circumstances. I think this is the first movie where Lou didn't get away with having a baby face and, you know, with a younger woman. But anyway, let's start the way we always start. Let's look at our creative and the background here. I told you that the budget was $700,000. The movie's 75 minutes, so it's really harmless. In fact, I don't think it falls apart until the Army gets involved. They started shooting on December 3rd, 1958. December 3rd, my dad died on December 3rd, 2020. And they wrapped up less than 3 weeks later, on December 22nd, 1958. So it took them 19 days to make this movie. Had they had better special effects, it would have been longer, I'm sure. It was released. It wasn't released until August 6th, 1959. And that's March, April, May, June, July. That's 6 months after Lou died. So Lou was not at the premiere, at least not in physical body. So anyway, let's talk about the creative team behind it. Let's start with the director, a pretty interesting guy. His name was Sidney Miller, born in 1916 in Shenandoah, Pennsylvania. Oh, Shenandoah, I long to see you. Ow! music lovers. So he lived till 2004. He was 84 when he died. But anyway, he was an actor, director, writer, songwriter. His son, Barry Miller, won a Tony for Biloxi Blues in 1985 as Best Actor. Oh, I didn't know that. I learned that recently. Great play, Biloxi Blues.
Yep.
Sidney Miller, during the pre-code days, like from 1932 to 1934, if you wanted a young Jewish boy, and I mean Jewish with the accent and everything, oy, vadi, oh, the ball, that was my Jewish. I just made myself. hey, you want to buy this? I'll give you a discount. That's the way he talked as a kid. At least he put it on for the pre-code movies. But, you know, movies like Three on a Match, which is one of my favorite pre-code movies, Wild Boys of the Road, one of the great William Wellman's movies, and The Penguin Pool Murder Case with Edna Mae Oliver and Jimmy Gleason. They made a series of those, Mrs. Withers Mysteries. So he was the go-to kid when you wanted a Jewish boy. Eventually, he became a good friend of Mickey Rooney's, and he made sure that he was in all the Mickey and Judy movies at MGM. He was a fine piano player, by the way, and got to show off his skills in these films. He was also in Boys Town with Spencer Tracy, Men of Boys Town, the sequel. I don't know what he was doing at Boys Town with the priest. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. From 41 to 43, 1941 to 1943, he was in a series at Columbia Studios, a short subject series for Jules White. And those were the Glove Slingers. That's something we didn't get as kids. We didn't get the Glove Slingers. Boxing-based comedies. And Shemp's in a few of them. So eventually, he was the second lead in those short subjects. And then he befriended Donald O'Connor. I guess he got sick of Mickey Rooney. He seems to befriend Irish entertainers. Yeah. But when he went to work at Universal, Donald O'Connor was like the young king there. And they became really good friends and collaborated on songs. And they would do the Colgate Comedy Hour together. They were like a team, actually, for a while. He was also in a series of monogram, low-budget musicals during the 1940s. He was part of a group that did that. He did a lot of radio. He co-starred and directed in a actually the first musical sitcom, and probably the last, I'd imagine. It was the Donald O'Connor Show. So he wrote and directed and also appeared on that show. He wrote and directed episodes of the Mickey Mouse Club. He directed like so many of our favorite shows. He also directed a failed pilot for The Three Stooges called The Three Stooges Scrapbook. That was in 1963. Mm-hmm. He's in movies later on. When he got away from directing, he appears in small roles in Yours, Mine, and Ours with Lucille Ball and Henry Fonda. And he played Hitler in Jerry Lewis's classic epic, Which Way to the Front? Which I always call it Which Way to the Exit. It's one of the worst movies ever made. In 1980, he and Donald O'Connor hit the road again. They'd hit the nightclub route. He did voice work towards the end for Smurfs and Scooby-Doo and a lot of other things. Mm. And his last work was on Father Dowling Mysteries in 1990. And that was with Tom Bosley. Yeah. Who apparently was a real pain in the ass in real life. And what's her name? The daughter of Ricky Nelson, who hit on me when we were on Broadway together.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Tracy Nelson in the play Grease. She was with us for like a month. And I had just gotten engaged, and she was hitting on me. And I'm like, yeah. Tracy, I'm engaged. And she's like, yeah, and? I'm like, boy, you played a nun? If you're listening, Tracy, I'm just joking. But anyway, he died of Parkinson's disease in 2004. And what a career. All right. So that's our director. He loved working with Lou, loved it. He loved the experience. He just wishes he had a better budget. Okay. The producer, Louis Rachmil, R-A-C-H-M-I-L, Rachmil. Let me wipe off my screen. There we go. He was born in New York City in 1908, lived till 1984. He was an art director originally, was Oscar nominated for the movie Our Town in 1940, based on that wonderful play. He was a producer and made movies for, he did the Hopalong Cassidy series for a while. Actually, the best B Westerns ever made, as far as I'm concerned, Hopalong Cassidy. They're serious, they're adult, and a lot of people get killed. He produced in England for the Walter Mirisch Company. And here he made a very fascinating film for me, Inspector Clouseau, in 1968, starring Alan Arkin. Yes. Right in the middle of the whole Pink Panther thing, all of a sudden, Alan Arkin, and it's terrible. They just didn't have a feel for it. And his last movie that he was producing was Footloose in 1984. How about that? Huh. Okay. The guys who came up with the story, this is interesting. These are two guys who were part of the special effects unit, Irving Bloch and Jack Rabin. The two of them submitted this story knowing everything about it because they were special effects guys, and they're the ones that wanted the good special effects. Now, interestingly, if you look at the poster for the movie, and I'm sure all of you have, it says it's wonder-filmed in amazoscope. But then on the actual titles, it says filmed in Wonderama and Matiscope. So sure. The poster says something entirely different, and both of them are entirely false. So basically it was a process screen. So nothing too complicated there. So you had these two guys, and I said in the book that it's almost like the game of telephone, you know. They submitted this script that was really great, you know, had all the special effects stuff written out, you know, the story idea. Then they gave it to a guy by the name of Lawrence Goldman. Born in 1907, lived till 1990, he was 83. He was a writer on some of the Jungle Jim movies with Johnny Weissmuller, you know him. By this time, he was showing off man boobs. this was a little late in the game. he had bigger boobs than, Maureen O'Sullivan. He wrote Kronos, the really good science fiction film from the 50s, Kronos. And this is the biggie. He wrote a movie that has the longest title I've ever seen. Are you ready?
Yeah.
For Roger Corman, he wrote The Saga of the Viking Women and Their Voyage to the Waters of the Great Sea Serpent. That was in 1957. Wow. And you know who starred in it? Abby Dalton, of all people, from the Joy Bishop Show. She was pretty. But anyway, that's the movie. I can't believe that title. And the sea serpent is in it for like 30 seconds, from what I understand. So typical Roger Corman con job. Just a nightlight for couples to make out in their cars at the drive-in. Which I got in on the tail end, by the way. I got to do that a few times at drive-ins. In fact, I remember I didn't see the movie Grease when it was playing. But anyway, that was a nice night. But anyway, they gave the script, the story idea that all these people worked on, and they gave it to some interesting people. Number one was a guy by the name of Arthur Ross. Now, Arthur Ross was nominated for an Oscar years later for a movie called Brubaker. So he was nominated for that as a writer. But before that, he was born in 1920 in Chicago. Lived till 2008, died at the age of 88. But he wrote some of my favorite movies, or co-wrote some of my favorite movies. Are you ready? Creature from the Black Lagoon. Ugh, I love Creature from the Black Lagoon. The Great Race from 1965. It doesn't get much better than that. He wrote another great one, Satan's School for Girls. Boy, the 70s, as we're drifting into the dumbing down of our culture. He was blacklisted during the early 50s, but then he came back. He's the father of Gary Ross, the writer-director of Pleasantville, Seabiscuit, The Hunger Games, and Ocean's 8. So his son carried on the tradition. Yeah. The other writer, I don't have much on him biographically, because there isn't much on him, but his name is Roland Barber, Rowland, R-O-W-L-A-N-D, Barber. And he wrote a book called The Night They Raided Minsky's, which they made into an amazing movie in 1968. Oh, if you want to know anything about burlesque, look up Night They Raided Minsky's. Great movie. He also ghosted the autobiography of Rocky Graziano, Somebody Up There Likes Me, which was made into a film with Paul Newman. And he ghosted my favorite star autobiography of all time, Harpo Speaks. Harpo talked into a tape recorder, handed it to Roland Barber, and he turned it into the greatest autobiography, I think, about show business.
I agree.
And that's him, born in 1920, just like his partner, and passed away later, 2012. Raoul Krauscheier, who wrote our theme song, it's Abbott and Costello theme song from their TV show. He wrote the score for this film. Lou was very loyal to the people he worked with, the people he liked working with. So those are our writers, the people responsible for this movie, such as it is. No, you know what? I'm hard on this movie only because it's very, very mild. It's Matthew says it in our book. He says, you know, it's not a great movie, but it's nothing to be ashamed of. It really isn't anything to be ashamed of.
Yeah.
It gets a little silly. It gets a little goofy. And it comes off as almost like a made-for-TV film because you've got so many familiar faces in it, you know, people that you would usually see on television. And the acting is very sitcom, you know, especially some of the soldiers in the Army. They're just so over the top. It's amazing. That one guy, I don't know who the hell he was, but they kept him in place, you know? And he's doing stuff Wally Brown used to do. Remember Brown and Carney? Uh-huh. Wally Brown, his whole shtick was not finishing sentences, you know, in his monologues. And that's what this guy did and all through the movie. Anyway, first of all, I want to go back to the poster. If you look at the poster that we have representing this movie, it's about sex. It's Lou holding on to the leg of a practically naked giant woman saying, oh, my God, she's all mine. And then it's a little cartoon of him working in his lab, and you see him thinking of a naked woman. So I don't know how they could be more wrong in selling this film. You know, kids, come see the movie. There's a lot of naked women. Mom, can I go see Lou and the naked women? And the giant sea serpent of Roger Corman. Okay, so we're watching a movie that is weird, seeing the Columbia logo attached to Lou Costello. Very strange. One question that hits me about this film. Can you picture Bud and Betty Abbott going to their local theater to see it?
Ooh.
That's an interesting question.
Very.
Because no proof of him ever seeing it or, you know, whatever. I know he saw, like, Lou on the Steve Allen show and stuff like that. But, you know, did he go see this movie? I doubt it. So anyway, one of the most interesting credits is executive producer Eddie Sherman, Edward Sherman. If there's money to be lapped up, you're going to find Eddie Sherman's tongue right there. Eddie Sherman. And the rumor has it that he just stopped answering Bud's calls. Bud needed work, and Eddie just couldn't find him any. And he had enough trouble finding stuff for Lou, you know, as this movie proves. So anyway, the movie starts, and it's a close-up of Lou. It's right up. That's it. Bam. We're in a Lou Costello movie. And he looks like 10 years older than he did in Dance With Me, Henry. Mm-hmm. He's thin. His face is very lined. He's got circles under his eyes. He looks like a man who's been dealing with illness. He doesn't look like he's going to die. You know something? If I didn't know that he passed away so soon after filming this, I would have never guessed. I would have guessed that he was sick and maybe needed his time away like he always did. But No, he looks older. He definitely looks older. It's also interesting that he must have read the script. He must have learned dialogue. And there's also another thing that I have the Blu-ray, and I wanted to look at his eyes during the close-ups to see if he was reading cue cards. Because a lot of the dialogue was very not Lou. It was not stuff he was used to, all these scientific terms and all that. I think I did catch him a couple of times reading, but what are you going to do? So did Marlon Brando, and so did John Barrymore. So he's in good company. Okay. So despite the corny jokes, oh, and by the way, I mentioned I saw this on Blu-ray. There is a release from, who is this? Yeah, it's Columbia Studios, released a sci-fi from the vault, and it's four sci-fi films in Blu-ray on two discs. And the best one is the second disc, has 20 Million Miles to Earth, great Ray Harryhausen movie, and 30 Foot Bride of Candy Rock. The other one, not so good, Creature with the Atomic Brain, and It Came from Beneath the Sea. So it's not just a B movie, it's a C movie. But anyway, it's but it's on Blu-ray in this collection. So yeah, anyway, that's it. So he's a scientist, and we see him with his lab coat in his lab, and he's mixing something very seriously as he's spouting these terrible jokes.
You know, Max, everybody, they're all laughing at us now. They also laughed at Einstein and his theory of relativity. Now everybody's got relatives.
Jokes of that standard. Yep. But the thing is, as he's making this concoction, we realize that he's just making a cup of coffee, which is kind of cute. Now, one of my biggest issues with this movie, and it would have changed things a little bit, it would have added a notch for me, is the fact that he's got a dog named Corporal, beautiful little dog. He barely looks at it. He never touches it. I mean, maybe once I think he puts it in the truck, but you can sense that there's no connection, that the trainer is doing everything. And no, even Dorothy Provine in this movie doesn't even look at the dog. So I don't know. I notice things like that. And to me, that gives the characters sympathy. You know, I tend to be more forgiving about the movie itself. But no, poor Corporal. He was on his own. And then there's Max. Now, this is interesting to me. Max is a computer that Lou created, or I should say Artie Pinsetter, that's his name in this. He created this computer, and it's basically ChatGPT. And I'm serious about this. When you do, I'm learning all about AI now and the chat platforms and all that. And basically, whatever you feed into it, you get back. And you'll get back variations and all of this. But you have to show them who you are and teach them, basically, before they can start really chatting with you in an educated way. So that's basically what Max is. Max, it also has Lou's voice, if you notice. That's Lou's voice. Yep. So basically, he's doing a ChatGPT thing. How many, 50, 60 years beforehand? 65 years? But I found that very interesting because that's exactly what it is. So anyway, he's invented this, he's got Corporal, he's making coffee, and then we realize that he's the rubbish collector in town, in Candy Rock. And he's got his rubbish route. He's got a truck that he doesn't own. It's owned by Uncle Raven. Raven. I love that name. Uncle Raven. It just tells you how dangerous he is. Uncle Raven owns every business in town. And he's played by someone we all love, someone we all know, Gail Gordon. Now, if you're a Lucy fan at all, you know that Gail Gordon was a part of every single television show that Lucy was a part of, including I Love Lucy, where he did a few episodes, basically. Yeah. But he was her first choice for Fred Mertz. And only because he was unavailable. He was already Mr. Conklin on Our Miss Brooks on television. And he had a few radio roles that he had to take care of. And he wasn't available. So they went with William Frawley. So then he was involved with the Lucy show. And then Here's Lucy. And then that horrible, horrible last hurrah in 1986. What was it called? Bury Lucy?
Let's say goodbye to Lucy.
Say goodbye to Lucy. Someone read the riot act to Lucy. I forget the name of it. But it was absolutely awful. And they had these 80-year-old people, and you know, Lucy and Gail Gordon doing, like, I don't know, slapstick. And as you're watching it, you're just hoping they don't break a hip, you know? It was that kind of a thing. Now, Gail Gordon was born in 1906, same year as Lou, in New York City. He lasted till 1995. He died at the age of 89. He was born to a vaudevillian, Charles Aldrich, and an English actress by the name of Gloria Gordon. Now, I have to say that he went into the acting profession. He was mostly on radio. He had that wonderful speaking voice. But I spotted him in a Wheeler and Woolsey movie called Hips, Hips, Hooray. And he's on screen for about 15 seconds. And he's got a couple of roles like this in pre-code movies where he's a radio announcer. And they just cut to him for a brief moment. So he did that to start, but that led to radio. And trivia tells us that he was the first Flash Gordon, but on radio. Because he had that wonderful voice. What else? He did so much. His big break was as Mayor Latrivia on the Fibber McGee and Molly show. And he's hilarious. He's a great counterpoint to Jim Jordan. And here's something. He was on a radio show in 1950 called Granby's Green Acres. Bea Benaderet was his co-star. And it was Green Acres. Basically, it was like a pilot for Green Acres that became a television show in the mid-60s. Yeah, he was the first Oliver Douglas. I'm not sure if that was his name in the show, but you know what I mean. He joined the Coast Guard during World War II, did very well there, apparently. And when he got out, he got the job as Osgood Conklin on Our Miss Brooks on radio and television. And I failed to mention this. He also appeared with Lucy on her radio show, My Favorite Husband. So he was even part of that, but it even goes back further, farther, thither, feather. Okay, I've run out of In 1938, he appeared on The Wonder Show, which was Wonder Bread, starring Jack Haley, and Lucy was on that show. So the two of them worked together from 1938 to 1986.
Wow.
Think about it. Yeah. Amazing. Almost 50 years together. Kind of a fascinating career. He replaced another radio legend. Joseph Kearns was another one that popped up in every great comedy show, drama show. And he replaced the late Mr. Kearns on Dennis the Menace as his brother, John Wilson. So Dennis could still say, "Hello, Mr. Wilson." I wrote a letter to the network at that point. I suggested buying Mr. Wilson a gun, but I didn't hear anything back. Hello, Mr. Wilson. Yeah, hello, Dennis. Say hello to my 38 special. He lived in a tiny town in California called Borrego Springs. I'd never heard of it. B-O-R-R-E-G-O, Borrego Springs. 1,500 people. He was the honorary mayor, and he would drive 160 miles to work with Lucy 5 days a week. Can you imagine?
Wow.
160 miles. Yeah, that's how dedicated he was. He was also very talented. He helped build his house. He did the construction. He built his art studio that was attached to the house. He painted beautifully. He built furniture, refinished furniture. And, you know, you'd never think that looking at him. And he did a hell of a cartwheel. You remember how he would do that?
Yes.
They might have even made him do that in 1986 on that show. I mean, that was like the extent of it. Unfortunately, he died of lung cancer when he was 89, 1 month after his wife passed away. So I think they were eager to be together. So Lou goes to buy some new tubes for Max, his computer. And Uncle Raven happens to be there. And he's being interviewed by a Mr. Burton, played by Peter Leeds, a very, very popular straight man for comics especially on television. Bob Hope used him all the time. But anyway, Peter Leeds is interviewing him for television because Uncle Raven is running for governor. Now, this is the funniest thing that Gail Gordon does in the movie. Every time he gets angry, he spots the interviewer looking at him, and he turns on a dime. He becomes Mr. Pleasant all of a sudden.
Yes. It's
a nice touch. I really like that about his character. But he does not like Lou. He knows Lou is after his niece, Emmy Lou, played by Dorothy Provine, and he does not want a loser for a son-in-law, or he's the uncle. He's not really the father, but he did raise Emmy Lou, Dorothy Provine, but not quite as high as Lou raised her. That was like 30 feet. So Lou buys those tubes, and Uncle Raven is forced to give him credit because it's in front of the television interviewer. So Lou goes on his rounds, his rubbish rounds, and he ends up at Uncle Raven's house. And Uncle Raven's wife is a very sweet woman. She's kind of cute. She's funny. But anyway, Dorothy Provine is their niece. Now, Dorothy Provine was born in 1935, which means she was 24 here, passed away 2010 at the age of 75. She was born in a place where I just was last week, Deadwood, South Dakota. How about that? Yeah. But she was raised, she grew up in Seattle, which means she owned an umbrella. Her parents ran a nightclub when she was growing up. She went to the University of Washington, where she majored in theater arts. Now, legend has it that 3 days after she arrived in Los Angeles, she was offered her first starring role in a movie. Three days. Oh, the struggle. It must have been horrifying. The starving and going to audition after audition and the rejection you face. 3 days. Anyway, but she was a cutie patootie, that's for sure. But the movie was The Bonnie Parker Story. She played Bonnie Parker. That was 1958, the year before she shot this movie. Did a few B-movies along the way, one of them being 30 Foot Bride of Candy Rock. She did a lot of television, mostly Westerns. She did 2 Wagon Train episodes. She did in 1959, this year, that this movie was filmed, into 1960, she did one season, and I didn't know this, one season of a show called The Alaskans, which is odd because it takes place in Denver. No, I'm kidding. but that was with Roger. That was with Roger Moore. How about that? And it only lasted one season, so I guess less is more. Mm. But she did have a major affair with Mr. Moore, who was very married at the time. You don't get dirt like this on the Oprah podcast. Okay. So she made some good movies along the way. Her big television show, by the way, was The Roaring Twenties. That lasted 2 seasons. And that's what everybody seems to remember her from, was The Roaring Twenties. I think she played a character named Pinky Pinkham or something like that. Anyway, she was in a couple of really good movies. In fact, I think 2 of the best comedies of the 1960s, which means she was in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. This was her name. She was married to Milton Berle, the daughter of Ethel Merman. Oh, yeah, yeah. Talk about a... Wow, I would have driven off the cliff with Jimmy Durante. And her name in the movie, and you really don't hear this, Emmeline Marcus Finch. So Emmeline Marcus. She was in another really good movie, not quite to the standard of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, or the other one she made, and I'll mention that in a minute. But she was in Good Neighbor Sam with Jack Lemmon and Romy Schneider and Edward G. Robinson and Mike Connors, one of my favorites when I was a kid. And then she was in the movie I consider to be slightly funnier than It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. I know everybody's rolling their eyes now, but The Great Race, also with Jack Lemmon, Tony Curtis, Natalie Wood, Keenan Wynn. I mean, a hilarious movie. And Jack Lemmon was never better. I just think it's one of his funniest performances. That the whole Prince thing, when he plays 2 different characters. And they're so different.
Yeah, he does an excellent job with that. And I have to agree with you that there are probably more laugh out loud moments in Great Race than there are in
World.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah. And it's a little shorter as well.
That too. Yes.
For Disney, that darn cat which I saw in the movies when I was six. I remember loving it. Another movie I loved, Who's Minding the Mint, directed by Howie Morris and with a comedy cast second to none. And it's so funny. It's about these misfits that get together to rob the mint, the government mint. Very funny movie, if you could find it. Really good. Also had Milton Berle in it, I think. And then a movie that just lied to us. It's another Disney production, and it lied to us from the title. It's called Never a Dull Moment. And I would change it to Always a Dull Moment. It's a terrible film. Dick Van Dyke and Edward G. Robinson again, and Dorothy Provine. So Dorothy did a lot of great stuff in her short time here, 75 years. And she retired like early on. She had, you know, like 20 years of quiet, wonderful retirement. So good for her. Good for her. And she was just beautiful, as far as I'm concerned. I just wish she wasn't so young. I say in our book that I think this role of Artie Pinsetter would have been better for Jerry Lewis. He was the right age, you know?
Yeah.
And I think he would have added the energy that Lou lacked in the film. And again, I'm sure you noticed, but his brother Pat was his double in this one. And you could see because he ran just like Lou.
Yeah.
And what I love about Pat, when he's the double, they don't mind him facing the camera, like in a long shot, because he looks like Lou.
Yes.
But good for him for taking that job. It must not have been easy at that age. So, okay, we've got Dorothy Provine, and Lou goes into the house to bring in the empty barrel so he could take the full barrel of trash out. And he has some good dialogue with the mother when he comes in. And I was going to say, maybe you should play this.
Hello, Arthur.
Hello, Mrs. Rossiter. Can I see you for a minute?
It's not because I don't like you, Arthur.
I know. He's the one that's keeping her from me, not you. You know, all of us would be nicer to each of us if it wasn't for one of us.
Oh, Artie, be careful. Don't knock over those jars of jelly.
I won't. I'm in enough jam already.
Well, keep out of that, too. Oh, that's a boy. Help yourself to anything you want, Artie.
Anything, Mrs. Rossiter?
Lou is actually sneaking Emmy Lou, Dorothy Provine, out of the house in this huge barrel. And as they're going out, of course, they run into Uncle Raven and what's his name, Mr. Burton. And they're still doing, you know, walking around, planning their big interview. And we learn about Uncle Raven's trees. He is absolutely obsessed with these trees he's raised on his front lawn. People told him for years, you could never raise these kind of trees. So he's raised these trees. And basically, this is just the Ming vase that you know is going to fall over, you know, later in the movie. Because the trees don't have a good ending. Anyway, so Lou gets away with it. He gets the barrel off and they go to Dinosaur Canyon. Now, Dinosaur Canyon is the Iverson Ranch in California. I've been there many times. And it's a very, very remote, you know, rocky, open place to film. It looks great. So here's the most uncomfortable scene for me. And that's where Dorothy Provine, Emmy Lou, is trying to seduce Lou. While Lou is, his mind is on science, it's on Max, it's on, you know, whatever, anything but romance. But it's very adult. She's trying to get him, you know? And then the whole thing about marriage, she just wants to marry him, this 52-year-old man with no money, and he's a rubbish collector. But she won't go out with the bank guy, you know, who's 26 years old. She wants the rubbish collector who's 52 and has no money. Okay, so believability just right out the window. Anyway, so she gets mad at him for not being attentive, and she goes running into Dinosaur Canyon, which has all this like smoke coming out of it. It's mysterious. We don't know if it's radioactive. We really just don't know what it is. But she runs in, and she disappears into this smoke, and Lou is running after her. Come back, come back. You know, we don't know what's going to happen. Blah, 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 blah. And sure enough, he looks up, and there she is. She has grown 30 feet. not like a centipede. I mean, tall, you know. but Lou looks up. He does this slow take as he looks all the way up and then does a backwards fall that a younger man would have trouble doing.
Yes.
I was so proud of him. He did it himself. This poor, ill man who still had some stuff in him. Great.
Yep.
Great thing. Anyway, so yeah, he sees this and he can't believe it. At first, he seems happy that he's got this amazing woman, you know, that's 30 feet tall. I don't know what he's planning on doing, but, you know, it would change plans a lot, you know? So basically, she's naked and she needs clothing. She's hungry. But mostly she needs something to wear. So this is the dialogue I want the audience to hear because it's very clever. Lou runs to Uncle Raven to tell him about what happened to Emmy Lou, and it doesn't come off quite right. And this is what it sounds like.
I need you, Mr. Rossiter.
All right.
You heard it.
How did you get her out? Where is she? I'll drive you out of town, every town, every place.
Emmy Lou is big.
Big?
Real big. And she's expecting...
Expecting? Emmy Lou? You're lying. It never showed.
It couldn't. It just happened.
If this gets out before the election on my TV show, Magruder! Emmy Lou, with you of all people, you tell anybody and I'll murder you, Magruder you!
Yes, Mr. Rossiter. I lost my glasses.
Oh, come with me. All right, Magruder, you're a justice of the peace. I want you to marry that whatever it is to my niece immediately. And don't you dare let this leak out. Got it? All right. Magruder has his orders. He'll look after my interests. And if Burton wasn't in town, I'd tear you apart. Now, get out. And no sign of you until day after tomorrow.
No, I gotta have some money. I gotta buy her some things.
Oh, blackmail too. All right, Magruder. Now remember, you are a witness. See? There.
Thank you.
Now.
So Uncle Raven believes that he's going to be a grandfather, but a grand uncle.
A grand uncle, yeah.
And he wants them to get married immediately. So he calls Jimmy Conlon, Mr. Magruder, who is the justice of the peace, and he sends them out with Lou. Now, Jimmy Conlon's character, Magruder, lost his glasses. So he can't see very well at all, which is very convenient for this scenario. Now, Jimmy Conlon, wonderful, wonderful character actor, mm-hmm. born in 1884 in Camden, New Jersey, not far from where Lou was born. He lived till 1962, died at the age of 77. But Jimmy Conlon was in vaudeville with his wife. Myrtle Glass was her name. And they would be Conlon and Glass. They started in 1918, and they had one of the funniest vaudeville acts I've ever seen. They shot two Vitaphone shorts. One of them exists. It's called Sharps and Flats, and it's their vaudeville act. I've seen it with actually about three or four times with a full house on the big screen, and it never fails, and it's hilarious. So Jimmy Conlon, right off the bat, he's a wonder. And he plays piano. Part of his thing is he plays piano, but it turns out to be a trick piano. It's just very funny. And Myrtle is the straight man. But anyway, he went into films, feature films in 1933, made over 150 movies. Can you imagine? 150 movies.
Wow.
My favorite being My Little Chickadee. He plays the bartender that talks about beating up Chicago Molly with W.C. Fields.
Yeah.
Very funny stuff. He was also a stock company member of Preston Sturges and his whole company. And he even shows up in Harold Lloyd's final film made for Preston Sturges, The Sin of Harold Diddlebach. And he practically steals the movie. He plays Wormy. And he's Lloyd's partner in this. You know, they're even on the ledge, the building ledge together with the lion, with Jackie the Lion. I even know the name of the lion, Jackie. Jackie was a great lion. his wife passed away in 1945. And after the war, he found that they were making less B movies. So he was not getting hired as much as he'd used to. But anyway, things looked up later on. He remarried in 1948, stayed married for the rest of his time. He became a regular on Duffy's Tavern TV show, the syndicated TV show. And just like Lou, this was his final film, The 30-Foot Bride of Candy Rock. So they were doing their last movie together. He shows up to marry the couple, the happy couple, and he can't really tell that she's a giant because he lost his glasses. It's not until after he marries them, and there's a pretty touching scene when he has to take the antenna from Max, which is a round thing, and he uses it as the ring to put on her finger. And I like what he tells Max. Well, you're the best man, you know. Doesn't the best man always have the ring? You know, it's sweet. It's kind of sweet. So they get married, and when Jimmy Conlon moves in to kiss the bride, he gets a look at who she is and what she is, and he runs for dear life. He's absolutely petrified. And you see him running, you know, he's like, he was no spring chicken at that point. What I love about this is that apparently he ran back to Uncle Raven and was telling him about his niece is a giant, you know, and Uncle Raven thinks he's insane and is going to ruin his chances to be governor. So he locks him in his basement with a bunch of wine bottles, and he just keeps him drunk and locked up. I mean, I don't know. You talk about authoritarian government, you know, he actually kidnaps him. So Lou is now married. He had gone to a army surplus place and bought a parachute, a silk parachute, so she could make her wedding gown. Thought that was kind of clever. Yeah. Came back with a big ball of yarn that didn't look so big when it was in her hands, so she could make clothing if she wanted to. But while he walks into the store, he runs into the town slut. I'm going to say it that way because there's no other way to describe it. I think her name is Jackie in this one.
Yeah.
And it's Viola Vaughn again. She was in Meet the Mummy. She was in Keystone Cops, I believe. Mm-hmm. Anyway, she's in a few. She's in a Colgate Comedy Hour with Abbott and Costello. She was born in New York City in 1918. So she was actually like 41 years old when she made this movie. And she looks great. She's the one I mentioned before that Jack Benny and Fred Allen both agreed that as far as radio actresses, and she was one of the busiest, she actually could sound like she was absolutely naked. So she played those kind of roles. You know, she was very pretty and had a nice figure. She lived till 1995. She died at the age of 77. She did mostly radio, but she also did a couple of Bowery Boys movies. She shows up in Paris Playboys in 1954 and Spy Chasers in 1955. And in both of them, she plays the femme fatale. And she's also shows up in Bob Hope's My Favorite Spy in 1951. That's the one he made with Hedy Lamarr. And in 1954, she appeared with Bud and Lou on the Colgate Comedy Hour. And her marriages, to me, are the most interesting thing. She was married to radio actor Hanley Stafford for 28 years. And Hanley Stafford was Daddy on the Baby Snooks show. That's what he was most famous for. And he did that for years until Fanny Brice passed away in 1950, I believe it was. And then she married someone else from radio. Are you ready? I'll give you a hint. Yes. He married Frank Nelson in 1970. Oh, and they stayed married until he passed away in 1986. Wow. So she married two of radio's really greatest performers, Hanley Stafford and Frank Nelson. Are you Viola Vaughn's husband? Yes. Who do you think I am with this wedding gown on? Anyway, so that's Viola Vaughn. And she's always a pleasure. And she's such a slut in this one. the new car, she keeps trying to take it. So Lou finds out that the 30-foot bride is absolutely starving. She's so hungry. She's so big. You know what I mean? That her hunger is out of control. So Lou has to go to town, and he does not have the money to buy the food that she needs. So he goes to the welfare office, And who is the absolute last person you would ever want to see in charge of your welfare? Charles Lane. Perpetual sourpuss.
Oh, yeah.
Perpetual angry man, Charles Lane. Oh, my goodness. My buddy Jordan Young, author, film historian, wrote a great book about the great radio comedy writers. Oh, my God, it's amazing. But he interviewed Charles Lane for that book, and he had no recollection of making this movie. So he has to go to Charles Lane and work it out with him. So Charles Lane, real name, Charles Gerstle, G-E-R-S-T-L-E, Gerstle, Leveson. So Charles Leveson. And he was married to the same woman for 71 years, to
wow.
Ruth Lane. My parents were married almost 70 years, so that's pretty impressive. He was born in 1905 in San Francisco, and he lived 102 years. He passed away in 2007. I'll never forget that. He was an insurance salesman for a while. Can you imagine Charles Lane? That's an insurance salesman. Well, can I get a discount on this? No. Eventually, he moved to Los Angeles, and like so many others, he joined the Pasadena Playhouse. And while he was there, a director and actor, Irving Pichel, or Pichel, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, he played in Dracula's Daughter. He was the homunculus, her assistant. And he ends up killing her at the end of the movie. So you don't need to watch it now, everybody. But anyway, he suggested that Charles Lane go into acting full time. He convinced him. And 4 years later, Charles Lane was one of the founding members of the Screen Actors Guild.
Mm.
4 years. Amazing. Just amazing. Always a sourpuss, every role. He was in a lot of Warner pre-codes, worked for 20th Century before it became 20th Century Fox. He made two that I can think of with the boys, Ride 'em Cowboy and Pardon My Sarong. He's in Arsenic and Old Lace. Frank Capra loved him and used him all the time. And he's in two of his best, Arsenic and Old Lace and It's a Wonderful Life, as Mr. Potter's advisor. He shows up on a couple of the best I Love Lucy episodes, one where she has to get the passport before the office closes, and he's the guy in charge, and he doesn't give her anything, not one little bit of relief. And then one of my all-time favorite episodes is when little Ricky is born. He's the other father sitting with Desi Arnaz in the waiting room. And now here's fascinating. Okay. The guy did 8 million movies and even more television shows. He just worked constantly, over 250 films and hundreds of TV shows. His last day on earth, he was 102. He was sitting up in bed, sitting up, his eyes wide open. He had a conversation with his son. When it was over, he closed his eyes and died.
Mm.
That was it. He died sitting up right after a conversation. Can you imagine? That's how I want to go.
Yes.
So I have to find out where his son lives and go from there. So anyway, so Charles Lane says, we're going to go to Uncle Raven and tell him what's going on. So they all go to Uncle Raven and they convince him that she really is a giant. She's not pregnant at all. She's, I love what Lou does. He says, she's not big this way. And he does his arms far apart. Mm-hmm. She's big this way. And he does the tall gesture. So he buys all the food, but this is a lot more complicated than you think. He's got truckloads of food and he's got the central casting driving these trucks. I always say that the best thing about Jerry Lewis to me is that he loved casting people that nobody cast anymore because they were old timers, you know? So you see a lot of these people pop up at Jerry Lewis movies because he knew these guys were professionals and they were grateful for the work. Well, this movie is filled with people like that. And it's just great. I think Joey Faye has the best line. The great burlesque comic, Joey Faye, who actually sued Abbott and Costello and Universal for using Flugel Street. But anyway, he's one of the guys in the truck and he's driving with this other guy. And the guy is like, you know, I've been a butcher for 30 years and I've never had an order like this before. I've never had to make a 90-pound hot dog. And Joey Faye says, you're lucky. I'm the one who had to find the bun. So I just think that's a cute joke. But you see a lot of these people in here. We've got Doodles Weaver. We've got Jack Rice, who played Edgar Kennedy's annoying brother-in-law during those short subject series at RKO, the Everyman series. And he's funny. He's just a funny presence. Let's talk about Doodles Weaver. How about that?
Okay.
Doodles Weaver, his real name. Ready? Winstead Sheffield Weaver.
Sure.
Yeah. Winstead. Can you imagine? Winstead. We'll use Winstead instead. Born to a wealthy family. Now, there are two places that I went to for references, and both had different things for his father. Both were wealthy, but one said he was a vaudevillian. But the more reliable source said he was a wealthy roofing contractor in Los Angeles. So that makes sense. You could make a lot of money as a contractor in Los Angeles. And as a roofing contractor, I believe he died of shingles, but I'm not sure. So he was born in 1911 in Los Angeles. He was the brother of Pat Weaver, the president of NBC all during the 1950s, and an executive from there on. He's the uncle of Sigourney Weaver, the great actress, who was the daughter of Pat Weaver. A lot of money in this family. He's of English-Scottish descent, which means he was too cheap to pay for an accent. His mother gave him the nickname Doodles, actually used to call him Doodlebug because of his big ears and freckles and stuff. He was a funny looking kid and a funny looking guy, actually, when he grew up. And that's where we got Doodles from. And he went to Stanford University, where a lot of rich people went. Turned out being married four different times. He suffered from depression and alcoholism, I hate to say. During the 30s and early 40s, he did a lot of radio. Had a recurring part on the Rudy Valley Show. He would show up every so often. And the Kraft Music Hall. He joined Spike Jonze's band in 1946. Toured with them for 5 years, did their radio show every week. He did a character by the name of Professor Fiedelbaum, who would mix up words. He would sing a song. And what is that called when they...
You talking about spoonerisms?
That's it. All spoonerisms. So yeah. That was his specialty. And eventually he did that wonderful racehorse thing. You know,
yes.
Fiedelbaum. He became mostly famous for that. And that was with Spike Jonze and his band. And I believe that was the William Tell Overture.
Yes.
Underneath that.
Yes.
Very funny guy. Very funny guy. Did a lot of TV. Ooh, in 1966, this I did not know, he recorded a version of Eleanor Rigby with the Spoonerisms. So it was a comedy version of Eleanor Rigby.
Wow.
Relinor Egby or whatever. So he did that. He did a lot of movies. He was in The Birds, Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. He was in The Nutty Professor with Jerry Lewis and The Errand Boy, my favorite Jerry Lewis movie. He was in Pocketful of Miracles for Frank Capra. He was in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. His final film was called Earthbound, and that was in 1981. Now, what we remember him from, now I'm not sure about you, Jerry, you were in the Boston area. In the New York area, instead of cartoons during certain shows, Doodles made these 6-minute shorts, short subjects, called A Day with Doodles. I even remember the theme song. Dum da dum da dum dum da dum, yum da dum da dum dum da dum, yum da dum da dum 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 dum. And he was dumb. But he played every role, you know, different costumes. And the narrator was basically a spoof of the Pete Smith shorts. So it would be, our hero is now trying to lie in a hammock. Uh-oh, he fell. It was that kind of a thing. But we loved it. A Day with Doodles.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Now, he had a very unhealthy obsession with an actress that he said that he would still, in his older age, and he only lived to be 71, but in his older age, he would still do like marathons. He would run and stuff. And they would ask him, how do you do it? How do you do it at this age? He says, I always imagine Cindy Williams waiting for me at the finish line with a big kiss. He was obsessed with Cindy Williams. Go figure. Yeah. Okay. And he talked about it and everything. Who happened to be someone I liked very much as a person. We had a full day in my bedroom together, me and Cindy Williams, recording an audiobook. So we were in my tiny little space together and we had the best time. And she was the sweetest lady. And I cried when she died. I had a cat that I loved dearly. I just want to tell this very quickly.
Okay.
And Gabby had health problems, had a major stroke when she was 6 years old. And it cost me a fortune. They put a vacuum cleaner to my bank account and it was gone. So Gabby was still alive and I bought her 11 more years of life after her stroke. And I told this story to Cindy. And Cindy had to go to the bathroom. She went into the bathroom. She came out and she had a check made out to me for $200. And she said, I just want you to put this towards Gabby's care. And I'm like, I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. I tore it up, you know, in front of her. I said, no, I can't. I can't accept this. But the sweetest, sweetest woman. Yeah, yeah. And when she was looking at my book collection, she noticed a book about Joan Davis, the great comedian. She went nuts. She just went nuts. I wanted to give it to her and she just said, no, let me write down the information. I'll order it myself. Ben Omar from Bear Manor Media. Mm-hmm. It was your book. If you're listening, it was your book. And she went ape nuts about it. Okay. So anyway, that's Doodles Weaver. He passed away at the age of 71 from 2 gunshot wounds to the chest. He committed suicide. Ooh. Yeah. But yeah, he killed himself. Depression, illness, alcoholism, just not a happy camper. So that was the sad end of Doodles Weaver, but he is bringing food to the 30-foot bride of Candy Rock. So they're bringing truckloads of food and blah, blah, blah. Everybody knows about her now. Now I'm leaving out my favorite shot in the movie right after they're married. Okay. And it's the wedding night and there's, you know, it's implied, you know, Lou is disappointed. There's one shot where he's just kind of looking at her and you see on his face, you could read it on his face. What am I going to do tonight? Seriously, it's like if you see it on his face. Yeah. And I'm sure he was directed to do that. But there is a shot in this movie where it's nighttime. There's a full moon. You see the stars. You see her laying out to go to sleep and she looks gorgeous. And then you see tiny Lou in the foreground looking at her and talking to her. That shot, number one, it must have taken them forever to put together optically in the camera. It's as nice as any of the shots in Night of the Hunter, Charles Laughton's beautiful, stylistic movie. It's the same kind of shot and it is absolutely gorgeous. And you'll know it when you see it. If any of you guys are going to be watching the movie, you'll know it when you see it. Just beautiful. Right after they're married. Okay. So she does the scene the next morning where she insists on making his breakfast because, you know, a new wife is supposed to make their husband breakfast. It was 1959, folks. Come on.
Yeah.
And she's got these adorable little props, you know, because everything is regular size. So she's trying to make eggs and they look like little tiny pebbles in her hands. And she drops one on the dog's head, on Corporal's head. But, you know, she can't do anything. She keeps spilling everything, the coffee, everything. And then finally she starts crying. And this was the second laugh out loud moment I had, is when the tear hits Lou in the face. And it's almost like somebody threw a bucket of water on him. It's a nice touch. It really is. So she's very upset about this and blah, blah, blah. I didn't mention that Carol Costello is in this movie and has a nice little scene with her dad. And she has obviously improved as far as her acting is concerned, because she was not that great in the earlier movies, I have to say.
Yeah.
But in this one, I could see where she might have a future. And again, she ended up with Craig Martin, Dean Martin's son, before she passed away of a stroke in 1986. She was, I believe, in her 30s or early. Yeah, in her 30s. A shame. Very, very pretty, talented woman. She was pretty talented. So anyway, Uncle Raven is absolutely terrified that the TV people are going to find out about his niece and what happened to her, and that would kill his chance of being governor. And that's really all he cares about, is the governorship. So what he does is he buys them a home, and it turns out to be 10 miles outside of town in an old barn. Yeah. And it's not like fixed up as a house. It's a barn with hay and everything else. So there's another great shot where she comes up through a hole in the roof and she wants a shower. She wants to feel better. She wants a shower. So you don't see any of the nakedness. You just see her from her shoulders up, coming through the roof of the building. And Lou is on a ladder up on the edge of the roof with a fireman's hose. And he's giving her the shower that she wants. And it's such a nice shot of him, you know, holding the hose and her enjoying the shower. Unfortunately, much like a plant, she starts growing again. And I love Lou. Don't grow! Don't grow! He just keeps yelling that. But anyway, she grows. And she's really angry. She's angry at her Uncle Raven. You know, he gives them a cockamamie barn to live in. He's trying to keep her out of town and under wraps. And she gets angry. Lou has to go back into town again. And he runs into a boosters meeting. Now, the boosters, they're the club that all the businessmen in town belong to. It's like a very elite club of businessmen. And of course, the man in charge is Uncle Raven. And they refuse, or he refuses, to let Lou become a booster. And that's all he wants. He just wants to be, he owns his own business, but they won't do it. So he runs in the middle of this to say something about, you know, his bride. And through confusion and the television interviewer being in close proximity, Uncle Raven winds up, in order to get rid of him, making him a booster and giving him a new car. Just to get him out, basically. So when he gets the new car, I really like the dialogue he says about, today I'm a somebody. He goes, I came from nobodies. My parents were nobodies. I'm a nobody. But today I'm a booster and I'm somebody. And it's really kind of sweet. He gets in the car, beautiful convertible. And who shows up but Viola Vaughn, who sees the car and says, move over, I want to drive it. You know, she's like this 41-year-old teenager. So she gets in the car and she's driving Lou to the barn. And once they stop in front of the barn, she stops to seduce Lou, mostly to get the car, I'm sure. And who should see them but a 30-foot bride. She's probably like 35 or 40 feet by now. And she yells at Viola Vaughn, who sees her, panics, and just goes running for dear life through 10 miles into town. And it's all desert, you know, it's all rocks and desert. And she's in high heels. Anyway, I notice all these things.
Yeah.
So our 30-foot bride is very jealous and very angry at Lou for messing around with Viola Vaughn. So I love this scene where she pushes the car and it just goes straight back, you know, like in top speed. And then he drives forward to keep talking to her. And she keeps walking back and forth. So every time she walks, he has to pull the car. He has to back up the car to be with her. Then she'll walk the other way and he'll have to go forward. So it's back and forth, back and forth. It's nicely done. So anyway, she decides she is going to go into town and have it out with Uncle Raven. She has had it up to here. And when she has it up to here, that's up to here. that is a tall woman. So she goes into town and I love this scene. And when we were kids, we loved this. It was like a regular 1950s science fiction movie where the giant walks into town and creates a little havoc. Yeah. Well, she shows up and she's standing next to the water tower of the town. And she takes the top off, right, the lid, and she splashes the water, and it looks like the ocean came down on on Uncle Raven. And then she does it to Viola Vaughn, of course. And then she takes the lid, which looks like a flying saucer, and she flings it. Okay, now this is where the movie, I think, falls apart.
Yep.
And that's when they introduce the army into it. And it becomes like this silly sitcom, you know, even the acting is all sitcom, overdone, over the top. And they're not real funny. You know, they're trying a little too hard. The army, the one guy, the shticky guy from the army, and I say the shticky guy, I should have looked him up. I don't know his name, but they gave him a lot of footage. And he's doing pretty much Wally Brown stuff. You know, I was walking to the thing, and all of a sudden this person, and he walked over, and he had this, and oh, everybody was excited. And when you see, it was that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And he does it one time too many. And I'm sure they said, we need some life here. We need some life. So they would point to him. So he sees them, and there's a good gag where he hits the brake because he's in front of this long caravan of jeeps and trucks, army stuff. So when he hits the brakes, everything behind him goes up in the air. You know what I mean? It's like it looks like they're all attached like dominoes. Yeah. So that's a nice touch. And the general is in the back, and he's like the most over the top actor of all. How am I going to explain this to the Pentagon? Anyway, we saw all this kind of acting on the Munsters. But then when she was taking the shower and her head was through the roof, a guy in a helicopter is flying by and he happens to see her. And I laughed out loud at this, I have to say. The helicopter it's going nuts. You see it's in fast motion and he's out of control a little bit. And he's trying to tell the caravan which directions to go, and it keeps changing. It's a funny scene. It really is. And I think the guy in the helicopter is better than any of the other soldier characters. He's actually kind of funny.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, the army gets involved. The general, for some reason, thinks they're being attacked by giant insects. Okay. So anyway, they start, I'm going to get to the conclusion here. They start bombarding what they think is the monster from Mars. They have put it together that there's a monster from Mars, there's giant insects, and the army has to kill whatever is not to their liking. And one soldier is like, no, no, you can't fire. You might hit somebody in it. No, no, kill them. We want to kill them. It's very accurate, actually. Right?
Yep.
This is where it gets all convoluted and not very funny, and I could see where they were going, but it didn't quite work.
Yeah.
Max, he was down for a while because they used one of his antennae, Captain Antennae, for the wedding ring. So she still had that on her finger, and Max was not working properly. So they put the ring back on Max, and Lou has a moment here where he's very chauvinistic, very 1959. I'm your husband. I'm the boss. You'll do what I say. You would think he was talking to Abbott. No, I'm kidding. That's a joke. She gives him back the ring. He gives it to Max. All of a sudden, Max has these superpowers. Now, this is Lou's plan. He tells Max, take me back in history where they don't have missiles and bombs. This is after they sent a missile. Max actually had the missile right in the sky, I love you, with a heart around it. And the army is just freaking out. What the hell is this? So Max is capable of some wonderful things. So one of the things is he takes Lou back to Civil War days. But unfortunately, they have sabers and swords, and they still have guns. So he has to go back a little bit, and suddenly he's Napoleon. And he's being chased by, you know, Wellington. And there's still cannons and all that stuff. So he goes, no, no, take me back before weapons. So they go back, and he's a caveman. But the thing is, they all surround him, and they start hitting him with rocks. So very telling that we have always been a destructive, ammunition-based society.
Yep.
All right. So then he decides, this isn't working. Take me back to present day, but make me fly above all of the turmoil. So all of a sudden, he's skybound. He's up flying in the sky. And my favorite thing is that when he goes up, he hits his head on a satellite. Mm-hmm. It's a funny bit. But he's flying around and yelling at Max, blah, blah, blah. Finally, he comes down. It's one of the worst pieces of special effects I've ever seen. It's almost like they took a cutout of him and used it in real time.
Yeah.
It doesn't even look animated. But anyway, he lands. All of a sudden, Max starts shrinking his wife, but she shrinks a little too small. She's still under the parachute that she was wearing, and you can't see her underneath the parachute, but she's there. And all of a sudden, the army shows up to talk to Lou, and they're stepping all over the parachute. And it really is scary because she's under the parachute. And I'm surprised Lou didn't say, get off the parachute. But anyway, they work things out. Lou is a hero because he invented this amazing thing that can time travel and change, perspectives and everything else. And he's got a contract from the army to take over and manufacture this thing. And so suddenly he's a rich man. He's a noted scientist. And Uncle Raven is very happy to have him as family. But Lou gives him that sound out of his mouth because that's what Uncle Raven did to him throughout the entire movie. Yeah. So Uncle Raven gets his comeuppance. And all of a sudden he tells Max, please, bring her back. Where is she? And she grows to the proper size. And Lou tells her, and this is a good ending. He tells her, darling, from now on, all of our troubles will be little ones. And he walks out, and who should follow them but their dog, Corporal, who is now a giant. And I love when he looks at the camera before he walks off.
Oh, yes.
But anyway, so I look at it this way. Since they treated the dog so capriciously all during the movie, he gets the final shot and the last laugh. So I was happy about that.
Yeah.
So that's the end. And when I say the end, that was the end.
Yeah.
Lou was very sick. Lou would come home from work. His daughter, Chris, talks about this. She was about 13 at the time. So she knows, this was a strong memory for her. He would come home and he would be gray in color. He was totally spent. He told interviewers, I don't want to do slapstick anymore. It's like, I'm too sick. I'm too old, to do this stuff. He goes, I would come home aching. He had a habit of when he got home, he would jump in the swimming pool and take off his makeup in the pool. So he would kind of revitalize himself. But he was really sick. He was very, very sick. And he looks it in the movie.
Yeah.
So they finished shooting on December 22nd. And on March 3rd, 3 days before his 52nd birthday or 53rd birthday, he died. He died of a heart attack. He had a heart attack at home. And they took him to the hospital, and he seemed to be recovering. And then one day after Eddie Sherman left, Eddie Sherman was talking to him. He left and the nurse was adjusting him. He wanted to be more comfortable, and mm-hmm. he passed away while that was happening. So Lou was gone, and he wasn't around for the August premiere of the movie. His wife, Anne, went to the movie and said that this would have killed him. Had he seen it? It was a strange hybrid of a film.
Yeah.
It was a spoof of movies that were already ludicrous. The 50-foot woman, Attack of the 50-foot woman, all of those giant bug movies and the amazing Colossal Man. What is it? The War of the Colossal Beast, which was the sequel. These movies were very popular. But a lot of critics said, to spoof them was sort of weird because they already were basically spoofs. So it's got the science fiction thing going, the satire. It's got sitcom kind of situations built in. And then it's got all the slapstick and stuff, especially towards the last third. So it's a strange, strange movie. I'm not going to say it's a bad movie because mm-hmm. let's face it. After 75 minutes, no harm done. I had a smile on my face. It just wasn't what you'd hope Lou's solo film would have been. He was so careful. He really wanted to show another side to him. And yes, he was more subdued in this movie, definitely. more subdued than he was in Dance With Me, Henry. But I think a lot of that had to do with his health issues. Now, Jerry, you've seen it for the first time. You watched it for the very first time. I want to hear your opinion.
Well, it is what it is. Ooh, and as you've said, 75 minutes was a blessing. If it had been 90, I don't know if I could have made it to the end. But as a spoof, a satire, whatever you want to call it, on these kind of sci-fi movies, the story works to a degree. I agree with you that the ending just needed much, much more. They had like 17 ideas, and let's do all of them at the same time. It was the feeling that I got. Yeah.
And maybe and if one of them worked.
Yeah. And it is kind of sad that this was his last movie. You never know. You never know that thing. You know, I remember Peter Sellers. He came out with the movie Being There, which is, in my opinion, gorgeous. One of the
his penultimate movie. And
yes, one of the finest things I ever saw him do. And then
I agree.
He passed away before the release of the fiendish plot of Dr. Fu Manchu, which was a blessing for him because he didn't have to see it after that.
I paid to see it. And
oh, I did too.
To this day. When you think you had a movie with Peter Sellers and Sid Caesar in it, and it was horrible. It stunk.
Yep.
So, yeah, I agree with you about that. It's kind of, well, it's not the same situation, but it is kind of, you know, he chose to make this horrible movie. I know he was hoping for a kind of Goon Show experience, you know. It just didn't work. It didn't work. No. It was dull. No. So, yeah, it was kind of sad that this was his final gift to us. And I do. Mm-hmm. I call it a gift. He was very sick. He was very ill. And his wife, Anne, passed away in December of that year, 1959. Wow. She was only 47 years old. So Chris became an orphan, you know, at that time.
Yeah.
Very, very, very sad. Very, very sad. So, yeah, and I know alcohol had something to do with that. After she lost her boy, it became very, very, very tense around the house, I'm sure. So anyway, so there was that. Lou did his last live work in Las Vegas. I believe it might have been the Sands. He did the Minsky's Review or the Minsky's Follies or something like that, where he actually came full circle. And he played Las Vegas doing the burlesque routines with Sid Field as his straight man. And apparently it was a very successful run. But, you know, Lou died and the reporters went to Bud's house to ask his response. Now, I've gone on record as saying that I don't think Lou and Bud saw each other after they broke up.
Uh-huh.
I think they each went their separate ways. Lou went to, you know, career land. He wanted to build a solo career. And Bud went home, basically. And I don't think there was, I don't think the twain met at that point. But it just so happens when Bud found out about Lou, he was watching the Abbott and Costello show, Who's On First? Who's On First was going on when he found out.
Oh, wow.
He cried. He said he lost his best friend, and it was very, very sad. There's sad pictures of him reading the headline.
Yeah.
A little exploitative, but yeah.
Yeah.
So, Bud, I'm sure part of it was, I was part of a team called Biffle and Schuster, and we made old shorts from, you know, black and white, and you couldn't tell the difference, basically.
Yep.
And my partner, Will Ryan, who played Schuster, passed away a few years ago. And when he passed away, I inwardly felt how Stan Laurel must have felt when Ollie died or when Bud lost Lou and knew that there wasn't anything left, you know? I mean, eventually he tried to do other things, but it was basically over, you know? And that's how it was for me with Biffle and Schuster. So, yeah, Bud must have felt that, hear the brakes screech, and he needed the money. He was still not completely square with the IRS. But anyway, we'll get to more about that. Our next episode, we're going to be looking at possibly just this movie, but I'm thinking we might add a few more things in the mix because there's not much to this movie.
Right.
And it's the thrown together compilation movie, this imitation Robert Youngson movie called The World of Abbott and Costello. And kids, they deserved so much better. And we will discuss that in our next episode. And in the meantime, Jerry, I want to wish you every good thing on your trip to New York. And have wonderful rehearsals. And be sure to eat a lot of pizza while you're there. And and we'll be in touch soon with our Jack Benny episode, number 39. 39. And we'll go from there with the world of Abbott and Costello. Jerry, you take good care of yourself, pal.
You too, my friend.
Thank you.